So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to Review Man.
It's the tradition. Starrcade 99, the granddaddy of them all. The Revolution faces Hacksaw Jim Duggan and three mystery partners. Who will Duggan bring to Starrcade? If Duggan wins it, the Revolution must take over the janitorial duties of WCW for 30 days. If the Revolution wins it, Duggan must denounce the United States. Sting takes on his former friend, the Total Package. If Sting beats the Package, Elizabeth's contract with the Package is null and void. Creative Control and Kurt Hennig doing the bidding of the powers that be. Face Harlem Heat and Midnight. In a crowbar on a pole match, the maniacal David Flair faces off with Diamond Dallas Page, looking for revenge on the youngster. For the WCW Hardcore title, Grievous Norman Smiley with the monster Ming. In a bunkhouse brawl showdown, Jeff Jarrett and Dustin Rhodes, the son of the man that invented the matchup at Starrcade. Johnny the Bull and Big Vito face off with Disco Inferno and Lash LaRue. Dr. Death Steve Williams with Oklahoma faces the Dark Angel Vampiro. If Vampiro wins it, he gets 5 minutes with Oklahoma at Starrcade. WCW Cruiserweight Championship on the line. Evan Courageous defends against his former significant other, Medusa. Who is the master of the powerbomb? We will find out at Starrcade when the Millennium Man, Sid Vicious, faces off with Kevin Nash. To win the match, all you gotta do, use the powerbomb. And the World Heavyweight Championship is at stake. The former tag team champions do battle one-on-one. Bret the Hitman Hart defends against Goldberg. It all goes down at Starrcade.
And I want to drown my sorrow. No tomorrow, no tomorrow. And I find it kind of funny. I find it kind of sad. The dreams in which I'm dying are the best I've ever had. I find it hard to tell you, I find it hard to take. When people run in circles, it's a very, very bad world.
Welcome everybody to the final edition of Review Away for 2010. And Way, first of all, I want to say Merry Christmas.
Thank you, John. This is actually the final Review Away for the decade.
It is. The decade technically does end with 2010 rather than a beginning, what some people may think. And Way, on this festive weekend, I wanted to give you my Christmas present that I got you.
Oh. You didn't have to give me anything.
I did. I'm
really?
Passing Way a bag.
I didn't
wrapped.
I didn't actually get you anything.
That's
John,
okay, Way.
Again this
it's
year.
Okay.
you gave me a gift last year.
Did I?
And I didn't get you anything, but well, thank you. Should I open it right now?
Yeah, sure.
Right.
Everyone's waiting here.
Two-way from John. It's a beautiful bag. I'm going to open this right now, carefully, because I want to reuse this bag in the future.
Oh, you're going to give it away to somebody else?
No.
Excellent.
Wow, okay, it is a t-shirt. And what does the t-shirt say? Free Wheezy. Amazing.
Because he was in jail, and now he's out.
This is fantastic.
Now, I also brought you the receipt in case
what?
You want to return it.
No, you don't
it
have
might,
to do
It
that.
Might be
Come
too
on.
Big for you, as I realized
what
later. Well, it's
I'm
a medium. I don't know, Way. You're a small guy.
No, I'm a medium. This is awesome. Oh, this is fantastic, John. Thank
okay,
you.
Okay, well,
thank you so much.
I hope you enjoy it.
This is great. I will wear this.
Not done yet.
There's more. Okay.
Well, we just finished a two-hour radio show,
yes.
So I figured now...
I was going to say I will wear this on the law.
We could have a Sapporo.
Beautiful. Thank you. This is
to go
fantastic.
With your coffee.
Wow, John. This is like I come here and the gifts and everything. This is just fantastic. Thank you, John.
Now, James, our operator, I feel terrible right now because I should have brought a third for you.
You didn't get him a shirt.
I know. You know what? I'm going to make it up to James, though. I promise, okay?
All right.
I'm going to make it up to him. Because James just informed us where there's coffee in this studio. We're not in our regular Review Away studio here. This is a much nicer place.
We can potentially get him into very big trouble by drinking in this studio, you know?
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, see? Now you...
No, we're good. We're good. Just, we're good. I figured I needed some alcohol coffee. To relive Starrcade 99 because this was... an interesting pay-per-view.
All right, well, James is his tea at least, so cheers, guys.
Yep, everybody, our Sapporo cheers. And our tea. And we're going to get into Starrcade 99, everybody.
That's very nice. Thank you, John. I appreciate it.
Well, you're welcome, Way. And if it makes you feel better, I didn't. It wasn't a terribly expensive gift, but one that I thought you would wear with pride. Well, I don't want you to feel guilty.
All right. Maybe one day I'll wear this to work, and you can wear that Big Baby Jesus shirt.
That's right. That year you got me that. I still have that shirt.
That's right.
Big Baby Jesus is my homeboy.
Yes. Okay.
Starrcade 1999, Way, taking place December the 19th of 99 from Washington, D.C. Now, it had been a year prior at the Starrcade event where they beat Bill Goldberg. And at this point in time, they were 2 months deep into Vince Russo and Ed Ferrara booking, which for those of you that maybe are new to Review Away, we did review that Halloween Havoc, their first pay-per-view together a few months back. And what an atrocious show that was, where it ended with Goldberg winning the title, which was vacated the next night on Nitro.
God.
So this was now they had 2 months to kind of plant their feet into WCW, get acclimated with all the talent, and this was the big show. Starrcade was traditionally WCW's biggest event of the year. And we were going to find out if this was, in fact, their biggest show.
We're going to find out if they will even have a conclusive ending to a pay-per-view.
Well, this is the biggest show of the year.
The greatest Starrcade ever, in Scott Hudson's opinion.
We get a promo to start off the show, where if you send in your cable bill, Way, you would receive a Sting mask.
I missed all these, by the way. I only got to see the matches, because on the YouTube, you could only watch the matches.
They didn't have the backstage stuff?
They had a few of them here and there.
Oh, wow. Well, there was lots of it, so I'm glad I have this VHS from the original airing of it to contrast it with. They open up with a video calling this the granddaddy of them all. They list all of the matches with the gimmicks and stipulations, which are pretty much every single match has at least one. And the video said everything about the problems with WCW at the time. Then we get another video to start the show promoting the Master of the Powerbomb match between Nash and Sid. That's right, Kevin Nash and Sid. We're going to have a Master of the Powerbomb match on this program.
Didn't we review a show with this exact same gimmick? A little while
back.
The
Master of the Powerbomb. Yes, we did. It was Sid and Vader.
Yeah.
On a WWF show.
There we go.
Which ended with what? A choke slam.
Yes.
We'd see if this one would be any better. Nash says he's the only badass in WCW, and he's going to powerbomb Sid straight to hell. Then we preview the Bret Hart-Bill Goldberg match for the main event, and Hart kept saying, "In Starrcade, I'm going to beat Bill Goldberg. Because in Starrcade, I'm going to show everybody who's the best." In Starrcade. Also had this problem with always calling it the WCW.
Yes, and also always saying people's full names.
Bill Goldberg.
Yeah.
The announcers for tonight's show, Tony Schiavone, Scott Hudson, and Bobby Heenan. Hudson predicts this is going to be the greatest Starrcade ever. Mm-hmm. I did not share this prediction at the start of this show, but we got to be objective here. Disco Inferno and Lash LaRue tag up to start the show against Johnny the Bull and Big Vito, who were called the Goon Squad by the announcers.
They're still the Mamelukes, aren't they?
They kept referring to them as the Goon Squad in this match, and they were assisted by their manager, Tony Marinara, before he was called Tony Mameluke.
Yes.
The storyline is that Disco is in debt for $25,000 to the Italian Mafia, who just happen to be wrestlers and is employed by WCW.
This is Tony Marinara's family.
Yes, they've come in to collect the $25,000 debt.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Disco is wearing a leopard print outfit. Then Tony Marinara comes out with a leopard shirt that is unbuttoned. The best worker of the four in this match is actually the fifth guy on the floor, that being Tony Marinara. Schiavone explains that Bull and Vito didn't come to WCW to become wrestlers. They were just hired muscle to collect cash. And right as he says this, Vito applies a vertical suplex to Lash LaRue. Vito then hits a super kick and does a weird karate pose. Johnny the Bull was the Scott Putski candidate in this match for the first of many on this show. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, someone else was on this card who kind of just erases any candidates.
I think our all-time leading winner.
By far. Stay tuned for who it was. Okay. Disco, to me, just did not fit as a babyface. And the crowd, they were somewhat into him when he got the tag from Lash LaRue. Then they showed the lead-in to this match. They showed some video where Marinara was doused in Marinara sauce. and then he was tarred and feathered. Yeah. And meanwhile, Lash LaRue was put into a body bag at some point. This is just the announcers bringing this up. I realize I took so many notes for this match.
Throughout this wrestling match, the commentators again and again try to recap this ridiculous storyline, and I just kept thinking, why would anyone care about any of this?
It stops even resembling a tag match, as everyone is just in, and the ref just stands there as all four are just going crazy. Vito then throws Lash into the back of Disco, who hits the last dance thinking that he hit Vito, but in fact it hit his partner, Lash LaRue, who then takes an impaler DDT, and Vito pins Lash LaRue. They double-team Disco after the match. An Irish whip spot gets fucked up where the camera cuts to Marinara, and we don't see the double-team maneuver that they use. They just cut away for whatever reason. Then they have a body bag for Disco Inferno, and they put him into the body bag after using ether. Ether way, which would you like to explain to the listeners what ether is?
No, I wouldn't.
It's some substance that they put on a towel and put Disco Inferno out.
Yeah, there's a chloroform.
They then toss the bag to the floor, and Disco Inferno lands on his feet inside of the body bag.
Wow.
And the WCW employees are just casually watching this man taken off in a body bag.
It was really funny trying to watch the ref try to wave off this kidnapping. Like, stop. You're not allowed. You're not allowed to kidnap.
Then they take him all the way backstage, take him out of the body bag, and toss him into the trunk of a car and drive off. Heenan just ends the segment by stating, Disco Inferno was 25, and it's on to the next match with Schiavone promoting the main event. So we just had a attempted murder in the first match, and a kidnapping.
You're allowed in pro wrestling.
So that's how you heat up the crowd, everybody. Heenan is in a black suit with a red necklace and shades. He looked like the Godfather here. And Schiavone goes over their three main events, stating that the third will not occur because Scott Hall has injured his knee, and thus they have stripped him of the United States title and given it to Chris Benoit, and the match is not going to happen.
What actually happened here?
I don't know, to be honest.
Was he actually injured?
Well, Scott Hall was, he might very well have been injured at this point.
Okay.
I don't know for certain. So then Chris Benoit comes out with the United States title, and he asks for the mic, which you always know is going to be a problem. And he says exactly what Tony Schiavone just told us, that, and then says, titles aren't to be given, they are to be won. And he came to DC way to kick some ass. And he said, people came here to see a ladder match for the U.S., I quote, heavyweight title. And he issues an open challenge for anyone.
Maybe he was reading off a prompter, and whoever wrote the prompter typed the V instead of the G on the keyboard.
They are one above the other.
W. I don't know.
The heavyweight title. And he issues an open challenge for anyone and considers the title vacant. And whoever wants the notoriety and prestige of being the U.S. champion can challenge him. Then we cut to Medusa coming out, and I thought she was answering the challenge, but is in fact in the next match, which is also a men's title match.
Yep.
And we've got Evan Courageous against Medusa for the Cruiserweight title way. This match was something else.
What is the storyline here, John?
They are a former couple that had a bad breakup. So they're going to have a Cruiserweight title match.
Because Courageous cheated on Medusa with Nitro Girl Spice.
Yes. And now Courageous had Spice in his corner. And Courageous comes out with a backwards red baseball hat and Spice, cargo pants and running shoes. And was our next Scott Putski candidate, and also a Scott Putski look-alike.
Sure.
They look very similar. Medusa hits a crossbody off the apron to the floor. Courageous then throws her into the steps, punches her in the face, and everyone boos him. Then he misses a top rope moonsault to Medusa. There's a second rope dropkick by Medusa that misses by a mile. Then we see a roll-through by Evan for an 8 count that Medusa cannot kick out of, so Mickey J just stops counting. He just gives up here.
Awful.
Medusa then has a powerbomb attempt onto Evan and nearly cripples the guy. Crowd is booing this atrociously. Then Spice gets on the apron and calls Evan over to distract him. This took approximately 4 hours for Courageous to walk over to her at the side of the apron. Medusa then slaps him in the back, and Spice was supposed to low blow him, but instead took like the most PG grab of someone's balls you've ever seen.
It was the most awkward low blow ever, because she was standing on the apron, Courageous was in the ring, and it was her job to, she was gonna uppercut his balls, I guess, but her hands gets, caught in the rope, in the second rope, and so it was the weakest looking, most awkward uppercut to the balls I've ever seen.
So Medusa hits a German suplex with a bridge and wins the cruiserweight title.
Yes. The same title held by Rey Mysterio,
Juventud Guerrera,
Eddie Guerrero, Dean Malenko. It just tells you exactly what they thought about that division at this point.
The only thing worse was after this match, Spice leaves with Medusa and starts checking her out. So they start teasing a lesbian alliance here with Spice and Medusa.
I didn't catch that.
Didn't you see her? She was like staring at her ass and licking her lips. Gene Okerlund is with Norman Smiley backstage, who's in a football uniform and pads to defend the hardcore title. Says he is cautious but not scared of Ming, and then screams as the producer tries to count him out of the interview. Obviously, they missed the count. Okerlund then says they are out,
yeah, they did.
And they continue on with the interview. And that leads to Norman Smiley against Ming for the hardcore title.
Well, hold on. Smiley says he may have soiled his pants in the interview and asks Mean Gene to check him out. And Mean Gene looks over and says, yes, you did. You did soil your pants. So he shit his pants before this match.
Wow. Right after Courageous and Medusa shit the bed. So we get this hardcore match. Norman Smiley brings out a dumpster full of gimmicks. Ming then takes a trash can and smashes it into his own head and then tosses it at Smiley. Ming then knocks the dumpster into Smiley in an aisleway and uses a trash can. They fight into the catering area backstage where Smiley is slammed through a table. Then Ming tosses a cinder block that misses Smiley. Then they use an extinguisher on Ming, and he runs through a tarp to get rid of Ming and hide from him. Then we get a backstage run-in from Fit Finlay.
Are you still talking about a wrestling match here? Is this actually what you're doing?
What are you talking about? This was the match. This is what was happening backstage.
This is an actual wrestling match?
Yeah, it's a hardcore title match, Way. Finlay runs into the hardcore match backstage and attacks Ming. Then Brian Knobbs also gets involved, and Ming murders Knobbs with trash can shots to the head. This match was not approved by Chris Nowinski. And he's tossed through cardboards. Finlay then hits Ming with chair shots. Then Finlay grabs a lead pipe, and he slips as Ming has to pretend to not see Finlay and takes a pipe shot to the back. This was horrible. And then Ming is out cold after this pipe shot, and Smiley comes back to pin Ming with one hand. And Nick Patrick checks on Ming and takes the Tongan death grip after the match. This sucked.
You know what? I actually didn't have a huge problem with this because...
The last spot with Finlay where he was right in front of Ming and Ming had to turn his back to make sure he didn't see him.
Well, whatever. But this is Ming. And Ming, to me, is a good plunder match brawler. The guy just goes all out and he just flips over tables and everything. He's exactly like you would imagine the Incredible Hulk, for instance.
Okay.
And it was fun.
David Flair is in his locker room and he receives a gift. It's a golden crowbar disguised as flowers. Way. Comes in a flower box, but it's a golden crowbar. Then we see Oklahoma, Ed Ferrara backstage with Dr. Death, Steve Williams, and they say Boomer Sooners to one another. Then they cut to the announcers, and that was clearly a mistake because then they cut backstage again to the Misfits, who all of a sudden are taking Oklahoma. I don't know what happened in the 3 seconds that they cut, but all of a sudden Oklahoma was in trouble. And next up, we have a tag match where Jim Duggan will have three mystery partners against the Revolution who are doing this militant gimmick. While Duggan is a janitor, and the build-up to this match was that they attacked Duggan with mustard.
Okay. The Revolution now, at this point, under the Russo command, they've since gone from being a team of rebels, of guys who felt they were underpushed, to guys that formed their own flag and their own government, and were against the American government.
They were trying to unionize, maybe. They were like the Tea Party.
It was so messed up from what it originally was.
Mike Tenay is with Duggan and says, no one knows his partners because they are a mystery, but they are all proud Americans, and they must go out and defend the country now take on three Americans. The stipulations are that if Jim Duggan loses this match, he must denounce the United States on Nitro. And if Duggan wins, the Revolution performs his janitorial duties for a month. These are stips you can really sink your teeth into and that you want to plop down $30 to see resolved.
It's a perfect trade-off.
So then we get The Revolution, consisting of Perry Saturn, Dean Malenko, and Asia. Do you remember Asia, Wei?
I do remember
it. Was they seriously came up with this woman and called her Asia with a Y.
Yeah.
Because Asia is bigger than China.
Yep.
And they took on Jim Duggan and his partners, calling up 1988, everybody, the Varsity Club.
Mm-hmm.
Mike Rotundo, Kevin Sullivan, and Rick Steiner, who were accompanied by Leia Miao, who was formerly Kimona Wana Leia in ECW.
Uh-huh.
Douglas has an arm brace on his left arm, so he is on commentary here. So we've got 4-on-3 in favor of the baby faces, with one of the heels teaming with a woman.
Yeah.
So it's basically 4-on-2 here with Asia on the heel team.
Well, when this match started, I thought it was going to be 4-on-4 with Shane Douglas, but then Asia is up on the apron, and I was like, what's going on?
Douglas can't work. So rather than just have Duggan pick two Varsity Club members, we had to have three so that they outnumbered the heels.
Well, it's not a club if it's only two people.
It's a special club. Anyway, who cares?
All right, let's go. Let's get into this.
Duggan looked gigantically fat in this janitor suit, and his offense was horrible.
Mm-hmm.
Duggan was working the whole first part of this match selling. It was incredibly slow when Duggan and Saturn were in the ring together. And this is when Saturn was good. Saturn misses a moonsault off the top that the camera nearly misses as they were shooting the announcers. Duggan then hits an Irish whip into the ropes, and Malenko hits him with a flag and has, like, the largest wooden pole in wrestling history. And, of course, the referee does not see this thing. This thing had to be, like, 15 feet. There's a brawl with everyone in the ring, and the Varsity Club get a decent pop here. Then it's 3-on-1 with the baby faces taking apart Asia as they put her in the Tree of Woe, and the guys all take their turn with Asia, which sounds a lot dirtier than it was here. Duggan then gets up, and Rotundo clotheslines him from behind. Sullivan hits him with a low blow, and Shane Douglas cheers. This coming seconds after the babyfaces, who had turned heel, just attacked Asia and took her out of the match. Shane is now friends with these guys, runs in, and he pins Jim Duggan. So Shane was a part of this match, Wei, which they never made clear. I wrote down here, fuck this show.
Did they tag him in?
Nope. He just ran in.
He just ran in.
Yeah. And then they celebrated with the Varsity Club, who had just spent the last 5 minutes beating up the Revolution.
Yeah.
Typical Russo turn here. Like the cliche Russo turn here.
This sucks so much.
And now we'd get Jim Duggan against the Varsity Club. That was the big program coming out of here.
Yes.
So great. Douglas then cuts a promo about Duggan having to denounce his citizenship, and tomorrow will be Duggan's darkest day.
Mm-hmm. Yes. He has to wrap himself in a flag. The Revolution flag.
Great. Gene Okerlund is backstage with Jerry Only and the Misfits, and they have taken Oklahoma hostage, and they are going to put him in a shark cage. And I was wondering here where Dr. Death was when they abducted Oklahoma, who we had just seen like 3 segments ago, together in a locker room together. So something happened here where they were separated, and now they've got Oklahoma. And that leads us to Vampiro against Dr. Death, Steve Williams, where, of course, there's a stipulation here, Wei. If Vampiro wins, he gets 5 minutes alone with Oklahoma. I noted here that Dr. Death was in the Varsity Club
right. In
1988.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe they could have made it 5-on-3 for
no.
the babyfaces if they wanted to.
No, let's just move on.
Scott Hudson notes, it hasn't even been an hour yet, and we've already seen everything. The Misfits bring out Oklahoma, who's hooked up with the broadcast team to call the match. And this was just so lame, this gimmick. It was just an excuse to bury Jim Ross. And it was clear that Schiavone wasn't a fan of Jim Ross either, because he took his shots at Jim Ross throughout this match. Vampiro hits a cross body off of the cage to Williams to start the match, which was exactly the first spot from Medusa and Evan Courageous. Oklahoma talks about yelling in sound bites and repeating calls and kept calling him Vampiro instead of Vampiro. The Misfits run in, and Williams cleans house. He is the heel, everybody, and overcomes the baby faces in numbers. And then Vampiro hits what is now known as the Trouble in Paradise that Kofi Kingston uses. Vampiro then attempts a spinning heel kick, but Williams catches him for a suplex, grounds and pounds him, and Charles Robinson is then thrown off and attacked by Dr. Death for a DQ finish. And therefore, Vampiro wins the match by DQ, and Vampiro gets 5 minutes with Ferrara. And Oklahoma brings up the fact that he pinned Vampiro on Nitro a few weeks ago, and he wants Vampiro, who's out cold from Dr. Death. And he's eating the clock here. Gets in the ring, DDT to Vampiro, a delayed Garvin stomp, and then Vampiro makes a comeback with a Uranage suplex, and then the Misfits all help Vampiro, and again, the heel is outnumbered by the babyfaces, a concept that Russo never learned and continues to do in TNA, and it ends with Vampiro pinning Oklahoma. Just a terrible show thus far.
Yes, Oklahoma in here actually catches some of Vampiro's kicks and actually puts up a real fight here.
Well, he did, like, indie work before. He was a creative member.
But I, did he?
Beautiful Bruce Bodine.
Oh, I don't care. This guy is a, this guy's a writer backstage.
Yeah, yeah.
And now he's putting up a fight against one of your, I don't know, one of your up-and-coming stars in Vampiro.
He was getting ready because if you cared to look ahead in history, Sold Out would be featuring Medusa versus Oklahoma for the Cruiserweight title.
Okay,
so you had to keep him strong for his title run.
There was just way too much happening here, and it was all too weird, especially with this band, the Misfits, all scattered around the ring. Years later, there have been... I've actually been through this with people at work. There's Eddie, who's a fan of the Misfits at our office. You know, I think I was one time I was like on YouTube with the guy, and he was actually looking up a Misfits video to show me, and this shit came up. So there have been people looking for Misfits videos on YouTube,
and this is their reference.
This thing of this band in a fake wrestling match, fake punching a fat man dressed up as Jim Ross. This is stuff that'll be on the internet forever.
It lives on, everybody. This is awesome. Then we go to a backstage segment. If you remember at this time, Way, Vince Russo was the power that be, and they would shoot it where you could you would never even see his back. You'd just hear his voice, much like they did in Seinfeld with George Steinbrenner, as with Larry David's voice. But it was Vince Russo's voice. And he's talking to Kurt Hennig, who is accompanied by Shane, who was Virgil, Creative Control, which was a tag team at the time, and La Parca. They're talking to the Hidden Russo, who said something big is going to happen tonight and basically doesn't give a fuck about their match coming up. Tanay is then with Harlem Heat and Midnight, who asks about the friction between the three. And Booker says, that's just a rumor. And Stevie says, don't sugarcoat it. And he buries Midnight. And Midnight says, say that to my face, which I could have sworn he just did in this segment.
No, I didn't see it.
Well, he cut a promo on her while she was standing there. So then we go to our match. Creative Control, Gerald and Patrick. Because if we didn't have enough inside jokes about members of the WWE roster, this was just bonus.
Who's Patrick? Pat Patterson.
Pat Patterson.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And they're teaming with Kurt Hennig to take on Booker T and Midnight.
Another woman wrestling with men.
Yes, but this was more than just a woman wrestling way, because this was supposed to be a six-man tag in a number one contenders match for the tag titles. But Stevie Ray didn't show up, so it's Booker T and Midnight facing Creative Control and Kurt Hennig.
Yeah.
Hennig had just lost...
By the way, Midnight is perhaps the most racist name you can give a black character. Maybe apart from Kamala. It's like bringing a white guy to Japan and calling him like a ghost. The ghost.
Midnight.
John Pollock.
Well, this is the same creative team who just before this pay-per-view had brought in Juventud Guerrera and Jushin Liger to have a tequila on a pole match.
Okay.
They're a very tasteful group. Hennig had just lost a retirement match at the prior pay-per-view, but it had been weeks since he returned. He actually returned the very next night after that retirement match. Stevie Ray got lost, I guess, in the 2 minutes since the interview backstage. He did not show up. They mentioned that the powers that be fired Paul Orndorff on Nitro for training Midnight.
All right.
Just kind of funny. The heels did have the advantage in this match, so at least we're progressing, Way. It was 3-on-2 here.
Mm-hmm.
Hudson puts over Midnight for understanding psychology so early in her career in matches.
Oh, yes.
Those are the exact words out of his mouth. Midnight is double-teamed on the floor by Creative Control. Stevie Ray shows up near the end, and Booker T says they don't want him, and then ignores him.
See, by this point, the novelty of having a woman wrestle is not even there.
No.
Midnight here.
We had seen it earlier. We saw a woman just win
a
title.
We saw it twice.
With Asia.
You're right. Yeah. I've already forgotten the last match. Watching Creative Control and Midnight work together was one of the most boring experiences of my life. Finally, Midnight tags in Booker T. Hennig breaks a pinfall by Booker with brass knucks, and Patrick or Gerald, one of them, pins him as Midnight is too late for the save because she's distracted by Stevie Ray, and then Stevie Ray walks off. So I guess Creative Control now gets a tag title shot. Exciting.
Who cares? Who cares?
Then we get a video of the character Seven, who flies to the ring. It's Dustin Rhodes, who then just buries his gimmick on television and becomes, quote, just Dustin Rhodes. And Jarrett wants to end his career at Starrcade in a bunkhouse brawl match. And Mike Tenay is with Dustin, who's wearing a Dusty Rhodes t-shirt. And the storyline is that WCW fired his dad, and that was bad business, and says Jarrett is going to bite the dust. And Jarrett jumps him backstage in leather chaps, and they fight into the arena way for a bunkhouse brawl match Starrcade.
When I was watching this, I was just so unhappy and so frustrated that this was only the ninth match on the show. And I still had five to go.
There were 14 matches on this show.
There were like 13 or 14
matches. Oh, my God. Apparently, a bunkhouse brawl match just means there is a wheelbarrow and kendo sticks with a guitar. Hudson says that Rhodes, quote, has heat with the powers that be after Dusty was fired, and that they tried to pull the Seven gimmick. They tried to put the Seven gimmick on him. Mm-hmm. This is the worst company in history.
Well, what exactly happened here? Were they going to go with that Seven gimmick? And wasn't it Turner that?
It was actually
turned it down.
I just read Dustin Rhodes' book actually, where he talks about it, and he claims that him and Dusty came up with the gimmick, mm-hmm. and even shot those videos on his own, mm-hmm. and that they felt it was too close to being like a child. Kidnapper or something,
right.
And they halted it. And apparently Russo wasn't into the gimmick either, so he was like, why don't you just burn your shit on TV and you can be Dustin Rhodes.
Yeah.
Thanks, right. Russo. So that was that.
Okay.
Hudson,
what is a bunkhouse brawl?
It's you have a wheelbarrow. You just fight with a wheelbarrow and a guitar.
Okay.
Jared is scoop slammed into the wheelbarrow. Rhodes is upset about the spot that Jarrett has been given in WCW. This is the storyline the announcers are conveying. He's upset about Jarrett's spot in the company. Rhodes then throws powder into the face of Jarrett, and Bobby Heenan then points out that it's powder, not salt. I thought this was nice.
Why?
Because they always call it salt, and it's never salt. It's always powder.
Fine.
Rhodes starts whipping Jarrett with a belt. Then Billy Silverman tries to stop him, and he's put in the corner, and Rhodes duct tapes him to the ropes and then tapes his mouth shut. Then Kurt McGillicuddy ran out to the ring and he freed Billy Silverman. Builds to a spot where Rhodes runs and kicks Jarrett in the balls in the corner. Then he does the same to Hennig. They fight back down the entrance ray. Rhodes climbs up one rung of the entrance set, and he jumps to kick Jarrett. Then he hits a running bulldog to Hennig, as Jarrett then comes off the ladder that he's climbed up with a guitar, and he pins Rhodes after the guitar shot off of the ladder.
Great.
What a great match.
I tuned out for much of this.
This was a boring match.
Who cares? Who cares about any of it? Why was Kurt Hennig out there? Who cares?
Because, I don't know. David Flair is then in a dimly lit room with the golden crowbar, and he starts attacking a teddy bear, and he's wearing a Halloween Havoc t-shirt. They air a video for the upcoming David Flair DDP match, and it ends with DDP yelling, "Hey, powers that be, I got your pay-per-view match right here." And he signals to his crotch. What the fuck does that mean?
I don't know. He's going to show his penis on pay-per-view?
Okay. So we get another stipulation match. It's Diamond Dallas Page against David Flair in a crowbar on a pole match that absolutely zero people wanted to see.
What match? Okay, I guess you had Brett versus Goldberg, but aside from that, what match here made any difference?
None. David Flair runs out from the audience. He looked like the kid from the Stan video with Eminem. And he attacks DDP in the ribs with the gold crowbar, and he has extra makeup on to make it look like he doesn't sleep.
Yeah, they just put really like they put purple,
like this purple
powder
Halloween shit
under. Exactly. That's why he was wearing a Halloween Havoc shirt. He hasn't changed since Halloween.
Clearly, he should have tried the best remedy, and that is watching this pay-per-view.
Yes.
DDP is selling his ribs on the floor. Charles Robinson orders that DDP cannot compete in this match and declares David Flair the winner. But DDP attacks David Penzer, and the match begins. I don't understand how he just changes his mind like
this. No, because he stopped Penzer from saying the final word in his sentence.
Okay.
So it's not official.
So if Frank Edgar like knocked out Gray Maynard next weekend and Bruce Buffer got into the ring and before he announced, and still, and Gray Maynard just attacked him.
The match continues.
Okay. I'm glad to know that. They were going for pinfalls on one another, which I didn't understand in a pool match why they were doing this.
They mentioned Shivani or Hudson said, oh, that was probably just instinct.
Flair applies the figure four leg lock, but DDP reverses it. Flair climbs to the second rope and grabs the crowbar. From the second rope, this crowbar is like dangling down and like touching the top turnbuckle. Just a stupid match here. Gets off the turnbuckle, turns around, and he gets hit with a diamond cutter, and DDP gets the win. Yep. So grabbing the crowbar played absolutely zero difference in the outcome of this match, everybody. Nope. In fact, it set up the finish for the guy that didn't bother climbing. Mm-hmm.
That's the strategy.
So after the match, DDP grabs the crowbar and attempts to attack David Flair, but Daphne runs in, making her debut, and covers David Flair with her body, and DDP leaves. And Shivani credits her with saving the life of David Flair and then calls it one hell of a match. And they explain that Daphne was this girl who sent in a tape to Nitro as a super fan who has a David Flair shrine at home.
Hmm. What a gimmick.
She's a David Flair fan.
I gotta say, though, David Flair looked better than I expected in this match.
Did he?
Yeah.
Okay. The next match, Way, is for the freedom of Elizabeth, and was one of my favorite matches of all time.
Really?
I'll explain why. Elizabeth is under contract to Lex Luger, apparently, to be his manager.
Mm-hmm.
And Luger, as a result, has been embarrassing her on TV. He put her in a match against Ming. He put her in a mud match. And Luger then is shown in a video cutting a promo wearing a FUBU shirt.
Right.
For us, by us.
Yeah.
And this is our next match. It's not Lex Luger anymore. He's just called the Total Package against Sting. And Luger comes out in a basketball jersey. And once again, like, when he's on a pay-per-view, we shouldn't even bother with the Putski Award. Like, no. He is so ridiculously jacked.
Yeah.
It's disgusting.
I think one day we'll have to rename the award.
The Lex Luger Award.
Yeah.
Because really, his physique is just something else. It's like...
it's magnificent.
This guy, I'm trying to make a sports comparison. He's like someone who wins an award a lot, but for wrestling.
He's like the Wayne Gretzky of the...
Sure, he's the Wayne Gretzky of steroid abuse. Congratulations. Luger, Shivani says, Luger represents years and years of hard work inside the gymnasium.
Yes.
Inside the gymnasium. I agree. They go backstage for an awesome vignette where Liz has a can of mace, and Sting goes to Liz and says, no, 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 I want to use the high-octane version. And he gives it to Liz, and she leaves her canister backstage and takes Sting's canister. And I just wrote down here, subtlety is an art. They fight on the floor. Luger's yelling at Liz to start the match. If you're a fan of mid-80s WWF matches with limited mobility, then this was an awesome match of the year candidate. They go back and forth. Liz is on the apron slapping Luger, and then Luger walks into punches from Sting. Then Liz brings the can of mace into the ring, and she goes to check on Luger, and Sting catches her checking on Luger. And she goes to spray Sting, but it's silly string. So Sting knew the turn was coming, which is very good for just 2 months of Russo booking to already know where the heel turn is coming.
Mm-hmm.
Then Sting back elbows Luger, sends Liz out, the logic of all this. After Liz has been put through all this shit on TV by Luger, why would she stay with this guy?
Well, why would Sting, after having caught Liz for turning on him, why wouldn't Sting just kick her out of the match, beat her up, or just send her to the back?
He's going to give her a taste of her own medicine here. All right. Sting hits a splash off the top for a two count. Sting then hits two splashes in the corner and then goes for the Scorpion Deathlock. But Elizabeth is too slow getting in the ring with a bat, and Sting has to wait for her to get in. He stops, tells her to put the bat down. Then he turns his back on her.
Oh.
Liz grabs the bat and hits him in the face for a DQ. And then she gets a chair for Luger. Luger stomps on the chair, which is on Sting's wrist, and then stomps it like 85 more times. Then uses a bat on the chair. Once again, subtle, folks. You know how much more effective it would be to, like, just hit it once and say that you snapped his wrist? Instead, he stomped on it like 90 times, like this goofy injury angle. And Shivani, in case it was subtle, says that... Oh, sorry. Scott Hudson first here says that Sting saw the swerve coming. And then Shivani notes that, I don't think we're going to see Sting for a while in WCW. And the trainers lift him and carry him to the back without a stretcher. They just carry him out like a corpse.
Okay. So this whole match was
shit.
Despite Liz getting caught, she still tries to force an interference anyway, and she had to do it like five times. Sting must be the
dumbest babyface
idiot ever. You catch
to the point that like you're rooting for the heels too.
Yeah,
just attack this.
You
idiot.
Did a pretty smart thing. You switched the can of mace to the high octane can of mace.
What is high octane mace?
I don't know. You did that, but then once you did catch her, you'd let this woman basically hit you with a baseball bat. Anyway, on to the powerbomb challenge.
Oh, wait. I know you were looking forward to this much like I did. I swear, watching this match, shocking as it may be to some people.
Oh, by the way, why was that one of your favorite matches?
Because it was just so stupid.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I kind of built that up too much.
Yeah, that's okay.
I have not watched this event since December the 19th of 1999, so I had no idea how this Powerbomb match ended, so I was very glad I was watching this like a fan for the first time, and boy, was I not disappointed. Hudson says that a Powerbomb from either man, Kevin Nash or Sid, is like a Powerbomb from two men as you're coming down from 8 feet in the air.
Hold on, what does that mean?
That means that Sid and Nash are the equivalent of two men.
But what do you mean a powerbomb from two men? I guess if...
In height.
Okay.
They're saying that if Sid is 6'6", the average man is 3'3". That's what they're trying to say.
So you're saying if I stacked two men on top of each other on their shoulders...
And the top guy lifted you up and powerbombed you, that's what it's like taking a powerbomb from Nash or Sid.
This is a powerbomb from two men.
What was great here is that in the video, they actually did edit out Sid's yes. comment because he said, "You are half the man that I am," when the infamous live interview was where
yes,
he yelled out
that classic promo.
"I am half the man that you are." And knowing WCW, I thought they would have kept the old one in.
And then just cut to Nash and Hall laughing at
awesome.
This idiot in the ring.
Nash does the suck it reference to start the match. Nash sells on the floor with Sid throwing him into the barricade and then uses a chair on the back of Nash. Crowd is hating this match. Sid then tries to start a powerbomb chant and the crowd just boos the babyface. We see an Irish whip reversal where Nash takes out the referee and Sid delivers the shittiest looking powerbomb of the entire century.
This was, you know what? This could have been worse than the Medusa powerbomb on Evan Courageous.
Which, if you saw both, Medusa did have the better form.
Oh, man.
Sid nearly dropped this man on his head. And then we get a run-in from Jeff Jarrett, who clocks Sid over the head with a guitar. Nash gets up as the referee...
Hold on a second. We had Kurt Hennig run out for Jeff Jarrett's match, and now Jeff Jarrett is returning the favor.
It's like dominoes.
Exactly. Everybody has to do one run-in.
Yep. The referee is... coming to back to life just as Nash is getting up, and Nash tells the ref falls back down. Nash is selling his lower back from this shitty power bomb, and he goes to lift Sid and he can't, so he goes to the referee and he tells the referee, "Hey, I power bombed him," and the referee believes the heel, declares Kevin Nash the winner. I wrote, this is the worst pay-per-view in history here.
Oh, my God.
This was your, like, semifinal match. This was, like, one of your main events you were promoting, and that's the finish you gave everybody. Knowing the main event finish you were giving them on top of it. Fuck these people.
You know, like, for all the talk about their you know, people wanting a WCW reunion.
I have not heard that.
Well, I have.
I've heard no one say they want that.
Well, for
Nate
Atlanta,
Melton wants one, maybe, but that's it.
No, certain people want them to do, like, a tribute like they did with the retro Raw, for instance. But, I mean, you can look back at WCW, but I just don't have many fond memories of there being great WCW shows.
There's a lot more bad than there was good.
No.
And for the people that point to, the, you know, the early 90s stuff, they were bleeding money in the early part of the 90s. They had a strong period for 2 years. 1998, they were printing money.
And but even those shows were shit.
They had good shows in that time. They had a good undercard, not a great main event. And by this point, they were just imploding. They were just dying. And this was just horrible. Horrible, horrible match, everybody. Kevin Nash and Sid. Worse than Evan Courageous and Medusa, and that's saying a lot. Mike Tenay is with Benoit. He says the challenge is still open to be the United States champion. So then Benoit comes out. Hudson talks about the smoke-filled rooms in Calgary that he rose from. And his opponent, Way, is Jeff Jarrett. He's going to have a ladder match for the United
Jeff
States
Jarrett
title.
Jeff Jarrett again.
Third match tonight we've seen.
Tony Schiavone's exact words. Jeff Jarrett again. The third time this man's come out. He just came up for a run and now he comes out for another match.
Oh, fuck.
By the way, it's completely counterproductive for a heel to be in this role because you, Jeff Jarrett here, he's already wrestled this bunkhouse brawl. He just came out for this run-in. It makes Jeff Jarrett here look like the complete underdog against Chris Benoit in this ladder match.
They wouldn't understand that if you were telling them that. Schiavone is so wrapped up in his own story that he ignores Jarrett's music even being played when they announce the mystery opponent, and then he has to sell it being a big secret. Jarrett says he's already kicked one ass tonight, that he might as well make it two, and says, "Crippler my ass. When I'm done with you, you'll be the crippled one and handicapped." Benoit brings the ladder into the ring first. Jarrett hits a baseball slide to the ladder that goes into Benoit. Benoit's bleeding from above his from his nose at this point. And, sorry, it was the announcers who first say that he's bleeding from his right eye. And then they say, actually, I think it's only a nosebleed. As if to say, who cares?
Mm-hmm.
Hudson then says, yeah, Benoit's cut himself worse than that shaving. And Benoit then has his leg wrapped in the ladder, and Jarrett pulls the ladder back, and Benoit lands back first while his leg is wrapped into the ladder.
Mm-hmm.
Benoit then climbs and nearly has the title, and Jarrett drop kicks the ladder, and Benoit flies to the mat, which gets a big pop from the crowd. Benoit recovers. Jarrett is out cold. Benoit climbs the ladder, and then in a spot that I always hate,
mm-hmm.
he's touching the title. Like, he's standing next to the title.
He's holding onto the belt in order to do his throat-cutting gesture.
And rather than grab the title, this prestigious title that he's put over all night, he hits a swan dive and hits Jarrett. Then he climbs again and grabs the title. And the announcers call it the match of the year. Big reaction from the audience. This was the only match that the crowd seemed to be in all mm-hmm. night. Yes, this was match of the night, but they had zero competition. And that was that.
You know, like, I mean, despite Jeff Jarrett being out there again, he did work very hard. Both men worked very hard.
Yep.
And yeah, this was undoubtedly the best match of the night. Again, that I agree with you. That spot I always have a problem with.
It's just a dumb spot when you're putting over how important it is to win this title and get this major feat to climb the ladder and get the belt, that when you have that opportunity
yeah.
and you choose not to.
You know,
why?
It would be more believable if there was, like, a real feud here and Benoit really wanted to hit that headbutt on Jarrett, but there was really nothing like that. But it's all right. Fine. Who cares? It's fine.
On this show, it was one of the more logical spots.
Yeah. Yeah.
They show a video for Bret Hart and Bill Goldberg. Bret says, quote, "You earn respect. You don't give it." And then they talk about, it was some clip from Nitro a few weeks ago where just the line from him saying, "We're going to excellently execute creative control." Just sounded so stupid, whatever they were involved with. Mike Tenay is with Bret Hart, says no matter what Bill Goldberg does tonight, he's going to lose. And then he walks off as you see this just horrible, horrible set they have backstage where you have like these stupid lights up. It just looked like a fucking indie show backstage. Mm-hmm. And this is our main event way of the biggest show of the year. It's Bret Hart against Bill Goldberg in a no DQ match for the WCW title.
Yeah.
Michael Buffer announces, and he says, tonight will show us who will lead us into the new millennium. The answer was the WWF. Instead of saying, are you, he forms it as a he says first, are we ready? And then he says, we are ready to rumble. And makes it a statement instead of a question. Shivani brings this up.
Huh.
He says, does his whole thing, and he doesn't make it a question.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Watching this match, Way, I totally blanked until Bret walked down the aisle that this is the match where he suffered his big concussion. Mm-hmm. And I did not put two and two together at all.
Yeah, it was really tough to watch it.
Hudson discusses the tough year Bret has had with the death of Owen Hart and how he could end the year with a positive by defeating Bill Goldberg in a fake wrestling match. Heenan says that Goldberg is an athlete and not some guy that wears a medium-sized T-shirt around the gym all day.
What?
He's not a fan of people who wear medium-sized shirts.
Well, like the shirt that you gave me.
Yeah. Goldberg doesn't wear a Free Wheezy shirt. Goldberg uses all his power spots early, grabs the leg of Hart, and they go to the floor, and Hart throws Goldberg into the referee. This was ref bump number, like, 85 on the show. There's a hip toss into the ring by Goldberg, who takes out Charles Robinson, ref bump number 85. Then misses a spear in the corner, and he hits the ring post, and this leads to a figure four spot around the ring post, which Hart has always cited was a spot where he did bang his head.
Yeah.
And he's always talked about that, saying that I did that spot after the kick by Goldberg, but in fact, he did the figure four first.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, if he acknowledges that he banged his head there, I mean, he could have done damage just there. The back of your head is the worst spot to hit your head.
And I rewatched this spot looking specifically at his head, and he looked like he smacked it pretty hard.
Exactly, yeah. I always remember him bringing up that, and he'd always talked about it as that spot taking place after the kick. Yeah. It was before. Hart starts working on the leg with
It's not like the rest of this match he was being treated very kindly either.
No. Sure, Goldberg was incredibly sloppy in this
Bret
match.
Bret was just getting tossed around all over the arena here.
Like, I think it didn't really come through in Goldberg's matches because they were so short. The guys just sold for him. It was when he did matches like this that it really exposed, like, how bad he was. Uh-huh. Like, he was reckless in some spots.
Yep.
Then we see...
he had that Ahmed Johnson style.
Exactly. It's fine. I was just thinking of that. Hart starts working on the leg with a figure four. The third referee is in the ring at this point. Then they're fighting in the corner. Hart swings a punch, and it accidentally knocks out Johnny Boone as he's winding up and hits him. Three ref bumps in this match. Then we get the kick from Goldberg that did all the damage to Bret Hart that ended his career, theoretically. And then it's followed by a spear, which could not have been a great follow-up.
Oh.
Hart then makes his comeback. The ref is out cold, and he's going for the sharpshooter as Roddy Piper walks out in a referee shirt. Hart is putting the sharpshooter on, and before he even locks the move, Piper turns his back, calls for the bell. Hart is pissed. Piper ignores him and then hands him the title at the entrance.
He does hand him the title.
He hands him it right at the entrance as he walks away. And the announcers say how it's Montreal all over again.
Yay.
And that's how we end this show, with the redo of the Montreal screw job.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
a horrible, horrible show.
And then they did the rematch the next night.
Well, Way, if you remember how they ended Halloween Havoc, they vacated the title the next night, and that's exactly what they did in the first segment of Nitro the next night.
Yep.
They had Bret vacate the title, then they had him face Goldberg, and that's where they decided to be more revolutionary from the Montreal finish. They redid the NWO formation with Kevin Nash, Scott Hall, Jeff Jarrett, and was anyone else in it? Who cares?
Who cares? Steiner, I think.
Yeah.
Steiner was in there.
Yep. It was, and then Bret ended up not being able to work the next pay-per-view because of his concussions. Russo was fired about 3 weeks after this. It was a horrible time for WCW, everybody. This, to me, was, WCW was over here.
Yeah.
They were really done here.
I mean, just the idea that Bret continued to wrestle months following this without realizing anything was wrong with him, it made that match especially tough to watch. And just to realize that they did all that for a bullshit finish with no resolution for people who paid for this pay-per-view.
0 out of 10.
I give it a one for that ladder
match.
The ladder match was good.
Still give me a zero. I was so annoyed after this. All right, so everybody, that was our review of Starrcade 1999. Coming up, we are going to be going through your feedback, and then after that, we're going to be joined by George Barbosa of the Fight Network to talk about his new documentary he has produced that is currently airing on the Fight Network and is also online at youtube.com/thefightnetwork. It's called Generation Evolução, and it's following Andre Dida and his brother Maurizio Veo, who are both now living in Toronto and come from the Shootabox Academy in Brazil.
Shootabox Academy, the home of many prominent fighters from Brazil, such as Vanderlei Silva, Maurício Shogun Hua, Anderson Silva trained there for a period of time. And these are just men that have come over from Brazil, and in the time that they've come over, just incredible things have happened to Dida, almost getting hit in the head with a stray bullet while training here in Toronto.
Yeah, it's some unbelievable access that George and the crew working on this this documentary got. And
great camera work, by the way.
Yeah, some phenomenal camera work. Some great scenics. Just tremendous job done on all ends of the camera.
Yes.
And as well, even if you're not familiar with Andre Dida, who competes for K1 Max, or Maurizio Veo, the pieces are just really well done personality pieces on these guys and just some incredible stories. And it really culminates in part three without giving too much away. But we'll be chatting with George Barbosa in just a little bit. But first up, let's get to our feedback here from you this past week. You can always leave your feedback to right on the Facebook wall at Live Audio Wrestling's Review Away Facebook group, reviewaway.com. We try to get to as much as possible. So let's start off your way with Richard Fulford. Looking back at the WWE at 2010, I can honestly say that I will remember most from this past year is the HBK versus Taker 2, as well as the Angry Miz Girl. I got to thank WWE in 2010 for making me feel guilty as a 34-year-old for watching WWE. Hopefully 2011 will see a demographic more suited to me. All the Cena shite is really getting to me. We have a saying in the UK that something is cheesy, and right now Cena stinks of cheddar. I respect Cena for putting in 350-plus days a year and spending 10% of his life in an aeroplane. I blame WWE. Give the guys a damn break with his family. He could use it, and we could definitely use it.
Okay. Chris from L.A. Thanks for the shout-out, guys. I also want to point out about the Slammies how Pillman held the envelope to his forehead and said, "I hope this award brings a smile to the winner's face." An obvious jab at HBK losing his smile. Also, it was very distasteful for Triple H to make reference to HBK and Sonny's sex life. As for Starrcade 1999, I have two questions. One, who in that company thought it was a good idea to push David Flair? And two, was there a bigger tool in WCW than Evan Courageous? I like the guy, but he was just so damn bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. He was more cheesy and corny than a plate of nachos.
A lot of cheesy references here.
Mm-hmm.
Jeff Johnson. I think graphics for all TV stations greatly improved in the late 90s because there were so many schools with graphic design programs. Now there's an oversaturation. That comes from our conversation last week.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure some of that has to do with how accessible these programs became in around that time, too. You know, everybody can download Photoshop and kids.
Well, that's the thing.
Learning.
It's not like some exclusive group now that are editors. It's really the user can really have quite a lot of power just from their home.
Yep. Dave Hewitt, just listened to this week's Review Away. Fantastic stuff, guys. Think you captured how cheesy the show was. Coincidentally, was listening to the show in a traffic jam on the way home from work. We've got a fair bit of adverse weather here in the UK. Took me 2 hours to drive 25 miles home. Does that count? LOL. I don't know. What's the coincidence there? Anyway, never mind. Also, with regards to the whole when do you record Raw Review Away issue, just remember, guys, Kind, K-I-N-D, kayfabe is not dead. Season's greetings to all.
Brian Hillhouse, I liked your bit on media content. As well as listening to your review shows on my MP3 player, I will listen to them on my PC while playing my PS3. I also have more episodes of Review Away and Shoot interviews on my MP3 player than songs because I find discussion and life stories more appealing. Anyone interested in great content along with the review shows should check out any Iron Sheik shoot and the Billy Jack Haynes conspiracy theory shoot interview. A lot of shoots are available on my MP3 format if you know where to look. On MP3 format. Why listen to music when you can listen to pissed off former WWE star Billy Jack Haynes explain his whacked out version of what happened in the Benoit house that fateful weekend?
Mm. Wow, there's some listening.
You know what,
material.
Me too. I think over the past year, I've just been listening to more and more podcasts than actual
songs.
I
listen to quite a lot, not just like wrestling stuff, but non-other sports stuff as well.
Erem Nizrala, fantastic review, guys. Come Rumble time, would you consider reviewing the 92 Rumble featuring my all-time most hated gimmick, Jameson? I hate Nightmare. I had nightmares about this guy when I was a kid and always had these of him with snot hanging down from his nose. I wanted to beat him up so bad until I got older and realized Vince was to blame for my nightmares. I really want to listen to your review of that show. And a couple of questions, if you don't mind. Did Bam Bam Bigelow fight Chemo in an MMA fight, or have I read that wrong?
Bam Bam Bigelow and Chemo, they did do a fight. It was, I'd have to look it up, but they did do a fight, and I believe Bam Bam got destroyed in it, from what I recall.
Okay. And there's another one. What do you enjoy watching live most, WWE or UFC? I was at UFC 99 Franklin versus Silva and at a WWE house show last November in Germany, where I saw a four-second match with R-Truth. But to be honest, I was more entertained by the WWE show. I was listening to your Best of 2008 show on The Law. How funny that every one of you said Matt Stryker was the best announcer back then.
Poor well, man. It was a very different style, Matt Stryker. He wasn't like his bullshit self that he is now. He was really good when he started. He was like just a very factual fan that came across really well in those ECW shows. And since that time, a lot of changes have come to
By the way,
story.
On Wikipedia, it does say that Scott Bigelow's one MMA fight was against Kimo Leopoldo, where he lost in via rear naked choke in 2 minutes and 15 seconds of the first round back in 1996 for a U Japan event.
That's what I thought it was in
And
Japan.
What do you enjoy watching more, John? UFC or WWE? Which one do you like live?
Live? Yeah. Definitely UFC.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You know, I haven't really been to an actual UFC sitting there live, so I can't really say. But I definitely prefer watching wrestling on television. I can just follow storylines of matches a lot better with the camera angles. I don't know if that.
Yeah, I mean, UFC is, it's cool to go to there more for the atmosphere than the actual sight lines. Like, I find visually, I do prefer watching UFC at home, whereas it's an awesome atmosphere at a UFC show. But I mean, in terms, even when I sat really close at the last one in Montreal, I was like, I was still watching the screen for the majority of it, and I do like listening to the commentary at home for UFC events. So in that regard, it's it depends on the show. Like a WWE house show, it can be a little taxing at times, but you know, it all depends. Ciaran Highland, love review away, guys. You guys need nicknames to go with the show. John lost his smile, Pollock, and how much does he weigh Ting?
Nice.
John only gets his smile back when TNA is good again. I love your interaction, especially John's bursts of disbelief and Wade trying to think of reasons why they could do something so stupid. Love the slammy 1997 review, the deadpan read of what that woman with gold dust said. Quote, I'd like to thank Goldust Penis was so funny. It's so bizarre seeing Undertaker come out to accept awards, seeing how protective he is of his character. But he must have hated that inane host pissing comedy bit. Yeah. Watching pieces on YouTube, the parts that I loved were the band that Austin steals the show with his stone-cold stare and awesome promos. What a bizarre show with its mix of juvenile humor and attitude-style smut. Keep it up. Quick question, are you guys ever going to release a review away separately from The Law, maybe a collection of old review ways. Merry Christmas, guys. If you actually go to the info tab, someone has uploaded the review ways separately. So you do have the option of getting them separate.
Alex Watts, in all caps, I hope WWE fires the Big Show. I hate him so much. He ruined so many great things this year. Just look at the SES and Jack Swagger. Every time his music comes on, I'm always like, "Erg!" I think he even sings his own theme song.
Okay. Don't know if you can blame Big Show for all these things that
I don't think he sings his own theme song.
I don't think so either.
It would be highly amusing if he did.
I'd want to see that on the next WWE Originals album.
A friend of mine told me tried to convince me once that Eric Bischoff sang his WWE theme song.
Really?
You know, that I'm back
and better than ever. That's the music we used when he came on the show, and he got mad at us for using.
I think all wrestlers should sing their own theme song.
That'd be great. It'd really translate. Lenny Wu. Oh, geez, listen to Review of Ron. I'm astounded with Way not knowing A Christmas Carol. Heck, I'm Chinese and know about Jacob Marley. By the way, I was surprised you mentioned Hong Kong on last week's Review of Way because I used to mail videotapes of WWF Raw, TNN Spike era, to a radio DJ from Hong Kong.
Well, you know what, Lenny? I'm not the only person out there who does not know who Jacob Marley is. Our friend Rob Scott from South Africa doesn't know.
Rob doesn't know a lot of things. So.
All right, okay. Daniel Stack, hey guys, love the review of the Slammies. I totally forgot that Mancow was on that show. I live in the Chicago area, and he was a hugely popular radio DJ in Chicago back then. Now he isn't even on in Chicago anymore. By the way, Mancow also wrestled Jimmy Hart twice on WCW pay-per-views in 2000. They were horrible matches. Gosh, that promotion was awful then. I can't blame you guys for passing on Starrcade 2000. You guys both seem really into this review, maybe because it was such an odd show and a change of pace. I have to say that song by Road Dogg was horrible, though. I honestly felt bad for him that he had to perform it live. Keep up the good work, gents. Happy holidays.
There we go. Andy Gordon. Hey, guys, I wanted to get your picks for fights at UFC 131. The one that will be a sure thing is GSP versus Jake Shields. What do you guys think? Also, who will be the Tough 13 coaches? My picks are Anthony Pettis and the winner of the January 1st show. First of all, for UFC 131, that seems to be the fight they are leaning towards, St. Pierre and Jake Shields.
Yeah.
I would say the only way they could throw a wrinkle in there is if John Fitch just looked tremendous against BJ Penn in February at the Sydney show. I wouldn't bank on that, though. They are talking about Velasquez and Dos Santos for the heavyweight title on that show. And in terms of the Ultimate Fighter 13 coaches, I really kind of hope they go in the direction of Dominic Cruz and Uriah Faber.
I agree.
I think those two, would really get across well. I think both understand their roles really well. Mm-hmm. And I think Dominic Cruz would come across as kind of the heel on that show. I think people just love Faber.
For me, ideally, it would have been Vanderlei and Chael Sonnen, but I don't think Chael Sonnen's cleared right now. And the other names that have been talked about, Mir and Lesnar,
it's
I don't
just
think
not gonna happen
either. What else we got? Jack Pisco. Hey guys, that WWE Raw this week was a weird anomaly in that it was only 2 hours without an overrun. Hopefully it is the start of a trend. Fuck, did the creative team go to town on Vicky this week? I know she's a heel, but she was already getting heat from the live crowd, so there is no need for a barrage of fat jokes. With the PG rating, do you think that they would try to write smarter material?
No.
If this is the best they can offer for the lead-up to the Royal Rumble, heaven help us. But then again, TNA has way more leeway in their booking, and they can't come up with better storylines either. With nothing planned for Mania, do you think they would try to sneak in a Cole versus King match to blow off their feud? What do you think?
No, I would not bank on that for WrestleMania.
I don't think so for WrestleMania either. Maybe a Elimination Chamber or a small pay-per-view, but come on.
They are apparently, Cole is starting to learn how to take bumps and stuff, so they do want to use him for some in-ring stuff. I don't think that's the best idea.
He is. You know, honestly, he is one of the top heels in the promotion right now.
I just don't see how you can necessarily translate that to, you know, maybe match at the end of this.
We just reviewed a David Flair match.
That's true. I wouldn't foresee that at WrestleMania.
Yeah, probably not.
Okay, let's keep going here. The next one is from Matthew Burrell. Hello, John Pollock and Mr. Ting. First, I just wanted to say some people make fun of Wei's full name because it sounds like waiting, but no one discusses the possibility that Mr. Pollock might be Polish. Mr. Polak. Anyways, your Starrcade review made me want to rewatch the Goldberg-Nash Starrcade 98 match. This match constantly blamed by WWF guys as the reason why WCW failed. But if you listen to the crowd, there is a massive pop when Nash wins. And the reunion of the NWO with the finger poke of doom on the next night's Nitro could have made the NWO the heel group everyone actually hated. If Goldberg hadn't injured himself, it could have been a good program of him tearing through the NWO and finally getting to Hogan by the summer. One of the biggest, I think, misconceptions people make are confusing a giant pop with something that is necessarily a strong barometer for business. Vicky Guerrero got fantastic heat last week on Monday. Does that mean she should be in some main event position? You, as a manager, you could definitely make that argument.
Yeah.
But I think at the end of the day, yes, people popped huge because Bill Goldberg lost.
Yes.
It was a huge deal. The guy had theoretically not lost a match in his WCW run.
Yep.
And it was, of course, people were going to pop for that. I'd be very concerned if they didn't.
Well, they were there live to witness something historical.
Yeah. you are not going to get me compromising on that finger poke. I thought that was just, it just it was pissing on the title, and I think it just made everyone just pissed off. Like, you had 40,000 people at the Georgia Dome, and that's what you give them? Mm. To me, that's such a fuck you to your audience. And it was just, it was a horrible show, which we have reviewed, and you can go back into our archives to listen to it. Mm-hmm. It was a terrible night for WCW. They booked Goldberg like an idiot, where they had, it was like some rape charge that where he was taken to the police.
Uh-huh.
It was a really weak show, and I don't think it was the right kind of heat that you're thinking would have been transferred onto the NWO. And I don't care if Bill Goldberg was completely fine after that angle. That thing was not going to work. And actually, he wasn't injured after that. It was the following year when he put his elbow through through the limousine.
That's so stupid.
That was in 2000. That was a year after the finger poke deal. So
when he got injured by putting his elbow through.
Yeah.
Oh, the window of a limousine. Perfect.
So,
all right, Eric Kremer. I had a dream / nightmare of Wei and John in the roles of baby Jesus and the wise man, respectively. I have come to call this abomination a Wei in a manger. That is all.
These guys are nuts. Jerome Clark, great review of the King of the Ring 94. That was my first pay-per-view I ever watched with my dad on Father's Day. I was telling you guys from time to do this review because I always thought it was funny. I remember recording this event, but I didn't get the whole show. The tape ran out. Years later, it was recorded over by my sister with some cartoon sad story. Art Donovan was funny to me. I always wondered, who is this guy? Who does he manage? LOL. My favorite line was, I think Double J's mad at me. He looked at me and said, come on up in the ring. I said, are you nuts? LOL. Great reviews. Keep up the good work, guys. And one other question. Are you guys reviewing the new season of Jersey Shore Season 3 in January?
Maybe.
Probably. I don't know. We'll see.
We'll see how big the demand is, which I don't think will be huge. Yeah. Stephen Smith. Hey, John and Wei. As someone who stopped watching wrestling in 2005 but still holds a fondness for the business, I have to say how much I enjoy listening to Review Away every week. Although I've still enjoyed the occasional shoot interview and wrestling autobiography, it's the two of you who have not only revitalized my interest in pro wrestling, but made me join Facebook just to post this comment and tell you how much I love the show. If I'd known you existed in 2005, I might never have even stopped watching wrestling. You guys are a constant light in the frequent dark ages of wrestling. Keep up the good work.
Wow, we should frame that one.
Yeah,
that's
we should.
Quite the compliment.
Awesome.
Okay, we're finishing up here. Jordan Welsh, I actually ended up depressed when I end up watching Raw and Impact that I have given up so that I can just listen to you guys more often than not rag big time on it. I really only watch SmackDown or ROH, though I can only stream / download it. Question, though. When will you think there will be a time when we will see quality wrestling week after week on a global basis? Jokes. I gave up waiting for that a long time ago.
I think we're just so jaded. Maybe, like, if I was an 8-year-old kid, I would be ecstatic about everything that was on TV.
Well, I mean, you look at the time right now, like, I don't feel that people are complaining inside some bubble on the internet. I mean, you look at everything.
Yeah.
Pay-per-view is in the toilet right now.
Mm-hmm.
The product is nowhere near on a popularity level that it has been in years gone by. Mm-hmm. I mean, WWE still does very, very good business, but their pay-per-view numbers are just horrible right mm-hmm. now. And that speaks to me that something is not connecting where people are – they're interested to watch Raw on Monday nights.
Mm-hmm.
They typically skip SmackDown, and they'll probably get one or two pay-per-views a year. That's the average wrestling fan
yep.
to me. And – the same deal with TNA, where they might watch for an hour or so on Impact, but they are definitely not spending $40 at the end of each month on a TNA pay-per-view.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So
there we go.
Wrestling always goes it goes up and down, folks. There's times when it's interesting. Let's finish up here because we are running late on time. It's like 3:30 in the morning already.
Oh my god!
Some places. So. That is all for this week, everybody. You can, of course, post all your feedback.
We're going to talk to Mr. George Barbosa, are we not?
Yes, we are going to get to George right now, actually. But post all your feedback at reviewaway.com. And coming up right now, we are going to chat with George Barbosa. Joining us now on Review Away, someone who we get to see on a daily basis, and now he's just becoming a world-renowned filmmaker. George Barbosa joining Wei and myself here
on this
late Sunday evening. And George, first of all, Merry Christmas. How are you doing tonight?
Pretty good. Merry Christmas to you guys, too. A world-renowned filmmaker. That's an interesting title. I don't mind that.
Well, you've put together quite the resume in 2010. You worked with me and Wei on Survival of the Hitman, and now this, which is getting a lot of positive buzz online. I think the highlight being that David Tank Abbott was tweeting about this documentary last week.
Oh, wow, yeah. Amazing. I mean, yeah, we've gotten a lot of pretty good response. It's all over the net, obviously, on our YouTube channel, Fight Networks, on the website and all that. And it was a fun project to work on.
So tell us first, George, just a bit about the concept. For some people who have heard about the Shoot-A-Box Academy, tell us a bit about how Andre Dida and Maurizio Vail were attached to Shoot-A-Box and kind of the story you set out to tell here in this this documentary.
Well, this one was actually funny. It just sort of happened by chance. We were originally just going to do a news piece on Andre Dida coming to Toronto. And then from there, it just sort of took on a life of its own, you know. Maurizio Vail was part of Shoot-A-Box, you know, during that time when Anderson Silva was there, Vanderlei, Pele, and all the big names. And he trained alongside those guys. And if you watch the first part, you'll see Vail sort of telling some of that history. And he talks about how he was just friends with these guys. They were teenagers, and they were friends hanging out. And, you know, so when we originally set out just to do a piece on Dida coming in and Vail starts telling the stories, we said, oh, my God, look at this material that we have here. Let's just keep going with this. You know, I figured, you know, let's keep going. Let's tell the story and see where it takes us. And then it just sort of snowballed and, you know, just kept going with it. And we got what we got today.
Now, George, this is Wei here. How are you doing?
Good, Wei. What's happening, my friend?
I'm doing great. Well, for those of you who don't know, I did work with George on this, being his camera guy for much of this the shoots. And like you said, I don't think any of us knew how long of a process this was going to be. Can you just talk a little bit about how much time it took to put all this together?
Yeah, I mean, this was something that, again, and Wei, I think you can... you can say the same thing, but it was just something that, you know, we started in August, and it was just planning a couple shoots that made sense and just sort of building on it and asking the right questions and then just being able to piece it. I mean, you know, we were there the first day Dida, you know, stepped into Toronto, and we sort of followed him since, you know, and sort of grabbed everything leading up to the K1 fight. You know, we were at the trainings, we were in their home, all of that stuff. And it does take some time to compile the best stuff and put it all together.
The documentary is divided into three parts. Can you just talk about which each part covers?
Yeah, if you watch the first part, you're going to get a bit of an intro. First part is more Vail telling his background, lets you know who he is. You know, a lot of people obviously don't know that he trained with Vanderlei and with Shogun, with Anderson. He was pretty instrumental in that, trained with Rafael Cordero, and he tells you that history. So you're getting that background information on the way to the airport to go get Dida in the first part. Second part, you sort of get Dita's story. You sit in with him during a training session, and he tells you a bit about his history, how he got into fighting, and you see some of his technique. You know, he's a very aggressive fighter, and you see that come through in his trainings and all that. And then as you get closer to the end, he just sort of hints towards the upcoming fight. The upcoming fight is interrupted by the shooting. There was an incident with a shooting that we capture in part three, and you see that in part three along with the trip to K1, the trip in Japan, and sort of the outcomes of the fight and all that happens in part three.
I remember shooting some of these scenics with you, and in fact going to the site of the shooting with Andre Dida for the first time since it actually happened, and we get him talking about, you know, what he was feeling, and he even mentions that, you know, he's feeling all that negative energy just but from standing at that place. I thought you did a fantastic job putting together all those shots and really just illustrating how dark of a mood it was, and just the idea that this guy, even after all this, had to go over to Japan in order to compete in this K1 Max tournament only weeks afterwards is incredible. Can you describe, you know, they were equipped with the camera, and talk about what they shot from Japan and you adapted into your documentary?
Yeah, like you say, I mean, I think for that third part, you know, a lot of that is just sort of showing the toughness of some of these guys, you know, that these kind of things happen, you know, and they push forward and they continue to fight, you know, and they don't let something like that stop them. I think to me that was the most remarkable thing of part three, and that's what, you know, it's like Wei was saying, that's what we were trying to show, you know, with the shots, the angles, you show that sort of somber feeling and that relentlessness, you know what I mean? Like, let's not give up, let's keep going. I think that was sort of the main focus of part three, what we were trying to get over. And, you know, then once you actually get into Japan, things sort of turn to a lighter note. And a lot of that stuff that they got in Japan, actually, they shot on their own, which was great. It was very beneficial to the piece, really helped out.
As we wrap up here, George, one of the quotes that Andre uses during the piece where he's describing the philosophy at the Shootabox Academy was where he states that everyone on the outside was our enemy. Can you just tell us a bit about sort of the legacy of Shootabox with these very unique individuals that were all working at this sport that was still discovering itself at that point, where we really didn't know what, you know, at that time, no holds barred, Vale Tudo was going to evolve into, and how Shootabox played a part in that, those developing years that would become mixed martial arts.
Yeah, Shootabox at that time, yeah, exactly. That quote that he says pretty much sums up the entire camp and sort of that attitude and the mood, right, that they had, Shootabox versus the world. It's sort of, you know, they didn't let anybody get under their skin. In fact, it was the other way around. They tried to intimidate everybody and tried to bring that that factor into it. And, you know, it's funny because in some ways this sort of brings that element of entertainment into things. And I think this is why a lot of the fans were so intrigued by these Shootabox guys. Here they are, a bunch of mean-looking, aggressive dudes, and they went out there and just pounded people who were aggressive with the soccer kicks and stomps and just had this style. I think that was really instrumental, because I think that style really attracted a lot of people, and I think it still does today. I mean, anybody with that kind of style sort of has that fan base. I mean, you know, Vanderlei Silva today still has that fan base from back then, you know what I mean? And people will go and watch that stuff on the net, and, you know, this is why that guy in particular, anywhere he goes, he's got a huge following. And I think, you know, same thing goes with Shogun and, you know, a lot of the stand-up guys that are aggressive. I think that really gets over with people. And what they were doing back then, you know, you still see some of it today, and it's great. It's great that they do it.
The documentary is called Generation Evolução. It's currently airing on the Fight Network, and you can also go see it online, the director's cut version. It's at youtube.com/thefightnetwork. George, you did a tremendous job, as well as the crew you were working with. I got to see it for the first time today, and I just thought you guys did a really, really dynamite job. And for those that maybe have only heard about Shootabox Academy, not knowing some of the stories involved with it, it's a tremendous kind of a tutorial on these two specific figures that were part of that legendary academy.
Yeah, it was great. You know, and again, I want to thank everybody that was involved in it, and I think we did a good job, and hopefully there'll be more of these to come in the future out of the Fight Network.
Awesome, George. Well, we wish you all the best in the new year. We'll be seeing you back at the Fight Network next week. And thanks a lot for joining us on this late Sunday night.
Hey, thank you.
All right.
Cool. Happy New Year's, George.
Thanks.
How did your girlfriend like that camera, by the way?
Oh, good, good. Really good.
Sweet.
So that was George Barbosa of the Fight Network, and you can hear Generation Evolução airing right now on the Fight Network.
You can hear it, but you can also watch it.
What did I say?
You said you can hear.
Oh, you can see, hear, you can touch,
smell,
observe, whatever you would like to do. Just interact with this documentary. You can go to youtube.com/thefightnetwork, and I definitely recommend it. I am very biased. We both know George very well, but it's very well done. Mm. So check that stuff out. And we're at the end of our, this is the final review away of the decade.
As we mentioned,
I was going to say this is the final time we'll chat with you this decade, but we do have Review of Raw this week.
Yeah,
so
right.
Just for everyone's schedule, we are doing Review of Raw this Tuesday. We will not be around for Review and Impact, and then next week we'll be back to our regular scheduled programming.
Correct. And for next week, John, I would like to, you know, a lot of people probably received their gifts and are enjoying them today. And maybe, if you're lucky, a few of you will have received this movie put out by the WWE over the past year called Legendary.
Yes.
And then for those of you that have, I encourage you to watch them this week and post your thoughts, because that is what we will be reviewing next week. Legendary, featuring John Cena.
And Danny Glover.
Mm-hmm.
And
Academy Award nominee. Some girl.
Some woman. So we are going to review Legendary next week, everybody. That will start off our year in just a tremendous mood, I'm sure.
I don't know about you, but I'm most looking forward to the photoshopping that will take place with the poster for Legendary.
That should definitely be fun. Mm-hmm. So we will end it off there. Of course, leave your feedback at reviewaway.com or just type in Live Audio Wrestling's Review Away Facebook group to interact with us, and we'll try and get to as much of your feedback as possible. We're back Tuesday mm-hmm. with Review a Raw, and to go out here, Way... I'm trying to think of something that would be very entertaining.
Whatever you're listening to, whatever you like.
Well, you know what? I am actually...
Oh. Okay, you go ahead.
What?
I was going to say, over the course of this recording, we have received some breaking news, and there has been a video of Caval giving his post-release reactions.
You know... We were discussing viral videos on the show earlier mm-hmm. tonight, so I think maybe this would be a great thing to go out to because we wanted to chat about it on the lawn. We didn't have a chance to. So here we go. Someone has created this video of Caval explaining his release from the WWE. So let's go out with this Caval video, which I'm sure is going to be getting the hits this week.
And you can find it on our Facebook group if you wish to.
Here it is, Caval.
Good evening. This is Caval. I done been fired. I wanted to know why I got fired. And Vince McMahon, he just say he don't know what to do with me, because he don't know much about me. He wondering if I'm Japanese. Am I like black? Mexican? To be honest, even I don't know. He asked me why do I have such a deep voice? Such a small man, and I ain't got the answers. I guess I'm like some kind of mutant or something. I jump in the air 50 feet in the air and land with both feet on the other guy's stomach. I'm like Bruce Lee. I'm like Mr. Bison from Street Fighter. But I guess that wasn't good enough to make it in WWE. I'm gonna have to go back to the Indies. Work for $15 a night. That's how much it costs to shave my head. I need to get it trimmed by a barber, or else I'm gonna cut my head with the razors, so I get a barber to shave it for me. I bought myself a new car, cottage, house. Gonna have to sell all of it. Move back into my trailer, in the back of the TNA place where they wrestle. All right, Caval, very disappointed, but I will be back one day with Marty Jannetty and Jake the Snake. We're going to group up together and we're going to make a comeback. All right, have a good night.